OMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, digital music transparency, tea in the park, YouTube, and Justin Jesus Bieber. I am Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. And this week we're not in such a rush, so might just talk a bit more slowly.
I think that's going to be more irritating than you constantly saying, quicker, quicker, all the way through the podcast.
Do you think?
I do think. It's sort of like the late night radio show version, except that we don't play music on this podcast, because normally you would, rather than having massive gaps of silence, you'd have some sort of ambient.
Well, if it was a late night radio version,
romantic music,
I'd have to speak lower as well.
Yes, and you've not got cold at the moment. It's helpful to be a little bit ill.
No, see, I can't do it. I haven't got that late night radio voice.
Someone on Twitter, I don't know who, but it was on Twitter, said that they chuckled 5 times during last week's podcast.
Yes.
I'm a bit disappointed with that. So I think we need to... Well, when I first saw that yesterday, was it yesterday?
Yes.
Whenever it was. Whenever I saw it on Twitter, I thought, that's not very good. I'm going to prepare 6 jokes for this week's podcast. But I've been very busy, so I haven't done that. But I still think that... Given we have a little bit more time to play with this week, we should not put any more substance and analysis and proper content into the extra time. We should just have more gags.
Okay. Well,
So you can kick that off, Andy.
Okay, well...
Well, actually, I mean, looking at the list of topics we've got to talk about today, the gags belong in the Justin Bieber story. And of all the stories we're talking about today, that's the one of which all I did was proofread your story.
Luckily... We may not have prepared any jokes, but Justin Bieber has prepared plenty.
That is true.
So stick around for that.
Just by quoting Justin Bieber from his latest magazine interview, hopefully we'll get more than 5 chuckles.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping for. Go on, Justin, you can do it for us. I have faith.
The rest of this, I have to say, not looking very joke heavy, but let's see how we get on.
Unless you want to do some racist French gags.
As I say, let's see how we get on.
How desperate are we?
As I said at the start, let's talk about digital music transparency.
It's a bit of a tongue twister.
It is a bit, and specifically in France.
Yeah, indeed. So would you like me to talk about it specifically in France?
Well, I can tell them what happened.
Yeah, so what happened this week in France about digital music transparency?
Well, France's Minister of Culture and Communications, Fleur Pellerin, has formally announced this week an agreement for a fair development of online music.
Now, when we announced that had been announced, is that all we do? Do we announce announcements? When we wrote about the fact that had been announced in the French Parliament this week, I was sort of mocking the really long title of the report. But then it occurred to me that actually in French it might be much snappier, and perhaps that was a little bit racist of me to sort of mock their choice of title when I'm not even looking at it in the language in which they've written it. So
yeah,
I apologise.
Learn to speak French before you
become
condescending.
If that's the case. So yes, this is France's culture minister. Earlier this year, initiated a report and asked a guy. Did you write down the name of the guy? There was a guy, Mark Schwartz. No, yes. Mark Schwartz. And he was asked to basically get together representatives from different parts of the digital music sector. So in particular, the digital services themselves, record companies and music publishers and sort of the corporate side of the music rights industry. And then the artist community. So it's artists and songwriters and people like that. And to tackle some of the debates that have been going around at digital music at the moment. And it included things like safe harbours, which obviously we've talked about a lot on the podcast. So in terms of the record industry and to a certain extent the music publishers too, certainly here in the UK, that's one of the big issues that they're talking about at the moment, how they think that services like YouTube and SoundCloud are exploiting these safe harbours in both American and European copyright law. And they want the law to be revisited and possibly revised in order to restrict the way in which these safe harbours are used. So that's what the record companies have been banging on about. However, although artists and songwriters and their managers have also been raising concerns about that area of copyright law, the thing that they tend to talk about more is transparency. And the fact that since the digital services first emerged, whenever that was, 15 years ago, and certainly since the streaming services have started to emerge in the last 10 years, the record companies and the music publishers, and in some cases the collecting societies that represent those two groups, have had to build new ways of licensing. Because obviously iTunes was quite easy to license because it was sort of the digital version of a record shop.
Yeah.
Whereas a Spotify or a Deezer, they're not like a record shop. And ultimately the relationship is a revenue share relationship.
Yeah, and as we discussed, there's all kind of complications within licensing something that sits between record shop and radio station and is neither of those.
Exactly. So you couldn't just say, well, we'll license you like we license record shops, not that you license record shops, but we'll deal with you like we dealt with record shops. You couldn't say, well, we'll deal with you like we dealt with radio stations. So something new needed to be created. And that something new has been created. And you know, it took a while to work out exactly what it looks like. But actually, now, most streaming services, certainly of the Spotify variety, have pretty much the same deal from both the record companies and the music publishers. There are some complications behind the scenes that we won't go into, but there's a revenue share arrangement, but then there are also minimum guarantees so that whatever happens, you know, if the streaming services has revenues of zero, they still have to pay money over to the rights owners. Mm. There are advances. There is equity for the rights owners in the company. There are other kickbacks. They get free advertising on the platforms, et cetera, et cetera. So there's pretty much a template deal there. And then the negotiations around the specifics, you know, what percentage revenue share, what figure minimum guarantees. But the point is that the record companies and the publishers and sometimes the collecting societies have done these deals. We know what the basic template is, but we don't know the specifics. And when I say we, I mean, why should we know? What right do we have to know? But the we includes artists and songwriters and their managers. Okay, so the more in tune people in the artist community and the management community know everything that I've just said. Basically, anyone who listens to this podcast.
Yes.
Okay? So the really informed together artists and managers who listen to this podcast understand the basics, but they don't know the specifics. And the reason for that is the dreaded NDA.
The non-disclosure agreement.
So when labels and publishers do deals with a Spotify-type service, NDAs are signed, which says that neither the label nor the publisher nor the streaming service can tell anybody the specifics of the deal. And usually it's limited to a very small number of people within the record company, within the publisher, within the collecting society, within the streaming service, who are allowed to know the exact specifics of the deal until somebody leaks it, leaks the contract, and then we all know. Although that has only happened, there's the Sony deal, wasn't there? There's obviously the big one where we do know the specifics, although that's obviously an old deal now and it only related to the US. I think there was another one. Was there a SoundCloud publishing deal went leaked? The YouTube indie label deal leaked? So there have been a handful of leaks. But in the main, no one's allowed to know the specifics of the deals. And this is annoying artists and songwriters and their managers because they are beneficiaries of the money that comes in. So when Spotify hands over money to labels and publishers, under the terms of the artist record contract and the songwriter's publishing contract, they're due a cut of the money, but they're not allowed to know how much money there was.
Yes, it would be like, I mean, you couldn't, going back to the record shop analogy, you know, you wouldn't, you know, sell your record in a record shop and then expect the shop to turn around and go, well, we sold your record, but we couldn't possibly tell you how much we gave the distributor and how much we took for ourselves. But here's some money. Just deal with that.
Yeah. So artists and songwriters are saying, well, this isn't sustainable because you keep paying us money and saying, well, here's your Spotify royalties and here is your Deezer royalties and so on and so forth. And, you know, artists who are bringing in decent sums of money will have accountants who will audit that money. But what the accountants say is, but what we can't audit it because ultimately it comes to a point where we say to the record company, OK, we're due, I don't know, 18% of the streaming income related to our tracks. This is how many times our tracks were played. OK, so what's your deal? OK, how of the money that is generated by those tracks, what percentage are you getting? What are the minimum guarantees so that I can double check that what you've reported and what we've received is what we should be? And what usually happens is the label or the publisher or whoever will say NDA can't tell you. And so artists and managers are saying this can't continue because it means that, A, we don't know if we're being ripped off, and B, We can't decide, you know, well, which label should we work with? Which publishers should we work with? If you're at a point in your career where you're deciding to do a new deal with a new distributor or a new collecting society or a new label, how can you make those decisions if you're not allowed to know what deals they have with what are becoming a key and will ultimately become the key revenue stream, certainly for the record industry, for the recorded music side. Plus, of course, there is all of the frustration around the stuff that sits on the side of the deal. So I mentioned that there are advances. We talked about breakage on the podcast. I'm pretty sure we did.
Yeah, I think we did.
So breakage is if an advance is paid to a streaming service, but the advance is for a year, but then in that year, actually, not enough music belonging to the label is actually streamed on the Spotify-type service, but they still get to keep the bit of the advance that they didn't earn. I'm not sure that was a very good explanation of it. I've definitely explained it better in the CMU Daily. So go and do a search on breakage on the site, and I'll explain it better there. But the labels take that breakage. Should they share it with their artists is the question. Actually, most labels now, mainly because of the press around this, are saying, all right, then we'll share the breakage. What about the equity? What about other kickbacks? You know, if a record company in their initial deal with a new streaming service says, well, we'll charge you, $50,000 setup costs. Well, really, there aren't any setup costs. There might be a bit of ingestion. There might be a bit of metadata work. But some would say, well, that's just a kickback. And technically speaking, record companies might say, and indeed Sony Music have said this in a lawsuit where this is one of the arguments as part of the legal action, would say, well, actually, under a classic artist record contract, we're not obliged to share any of that money with our artists. We only have to share money with artists if the money can be attributed to a specific recording on which the artist appears. If it's just general fees, general advances, general equity, we don't have to share that. And actually, that is probably a correct interpretation of most artist contracts. But what artists and managers would say is it doesn't mean it's fair, doesn't mean it's right. And so what this agreement, this code of conduct that the French music industry has agreed at the government's instigation is everybody saying, OK, we'll be a bit fairer. We will let the artists and their managers know what's going on and we'll be fair. This word fair is used a lot in these conversations. And any lawyer in the room will certainly say, well, what the hell does that mean? What do you mean fair? OK, but the aim is to create a forum through which artists can come to the table with representatives of the labels and say, we need to know this and we don't think that's fair. And there'll be some process to try and move that conversation on versus labels just saying NDA, 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 and artists getting very angry over here. And obviously, sometimes when those artists get angry, they then take it out on Spotify. And they go on their blog and they say, bloody Spotify, I'm not earning any money. And it's like, well, perhaps you're not earning any money off Spotify. Perhaps the Spotify deal is a rubbish deal, but you're not allowed to know that.
Yeah.
So actually, you can't comment on the Spotify deal because you've never seen it.
And quite often you can look at that. I mean, we've had a couple of examples of artists and songwriters kind of saying on Twitter, oh, I only earned this tiny bit of money.
80p last year.
And then when you go and look at their, I mean, Spotify says how many streams their tracks have had, and you can look at those and you can go, well, this amount of streams would equate roughly to, you know, you can work out roughly what sort of money it would equate to, at which point you kind of go, well,
yes, well, something's happening.
Something's happened in the middle when between, you know, these plays happening and you receiving your money, which quite probably isn't Spotify's fault. But because no one can know, Spotify can't tell you that it's not their fault because they're not allowed to talk about it. The label can't say, well, it's our fault, we're taking more money, but you signed up to a deal that was unfair to you and that's your fault. No one knows what's happening. Well, people know what's happening.
They don't know the specifics.
They don't know the specifics.
And it's the specifics that matter.
That's the problem.
Two things to add to this, I suppose, is first of all, I mean, you mentioned that various artists have sort of put their royalty statements or they've put their top line figures online and moaned about it. And Dan Lassac wrote a great column for us earlier this year, which if you haven't read it, it's worth going to have a look on the website. Andy, we'll put a link to it in the podcast notes.
Sure.
You'll remember that, won't you?
Yeah, probably.
And that was, who was it who he was commenting on?
It was it Jeff Barrow?
It was.
Portishead.
Off of Portishead.
Dan went and reverse engineered what he said he'd got from, I think, 3 million streams.
Yes, and it seemed like a very small sum of money, but Dan did some maths. And, I mean, he was a bit of guesswork, a little bit of simplification on the actual sums, but basically it was to show the process of how if you went back up the chain, what seems like quite a small sum of money once it reaches the artist may well have been a massive sum of money when it went from the streaming service over to the record company, the music publisher, and all of the other people. So do check that out. And then the other thing to say is, Here in the UK, the Music Managers Forum have commissioned a report which is aiming to explain. Now, it's not going to reveal the specific confidential figures, but it's going to explain in much more detail how these deals are done and why they're done that way and what, how it links into what copyright law says or what legacy contracts say or just the way that music rights have traditionally worked, particularly with collecting societies, so that artists and managers can have a starting point of saying, OK, we understand the basic framework. Now, these are the little gaps of knowledge that we're being deprived because of these NDAs, and now we can have a much more informed debate.
Yes, and we're in a fairly unique position to discuss that report because it was written by Chris Cook.
Yes.
Who's in the room here now.
So that's
Hello,
how
Chris
I know.
Cook.
Although I can't really say anything because it's coming out on later this month.
Maybe we will discuss that when it actually
so
comes out.
So once it's out, then I will tell you more.
When does it come out?
13th, I think. 13th of October. It's either the 13th or the 14th. I'm pretty sure it's the 13th.
We will revisit it after
that. So we will talk about that. But the aim of that is to sort of educate and inform everybody of, well, this is how it works. You know, that 2 minutes of Chris talking on the podcast. Let me explain in slightly more detailed, formulaic way. This is how it works. These are where the bits of information are missing. And perhaps this is what you as artists should be campaigning for. So that's all very interesting. But it will be also interesting to see if this deal in France between the labels and the digital services and the artist results in information flowing and indeed what sort of conversations may be happening with regards the fair distribution of income. The indies, through the WIND declaration, the World Independent Network declaration, to an extent have already made that commitment that we will be fair, you know, and obviously we talked about the Deezer IPO last week. I mean, it may well be that there is some money to be had. If Deezer floats, then that equity has value as of next year. If one of the labels chooses to sell that equity, what will they do with it? And obviously Deezer, French-based company, it could be the first test of this agreement to be fair. Well, what the hell does that mean? And have the French government, through these conversations, put together a more formal agreement between the different stakeholders that we can actually get some clarification on what fair means. So it's an interesting development this week, and it'll be interesting to see how that code of conduct and that relationship develops.
Tea in the Park now, proving to be, once again, quite a controversial festival.
It's been a bit of a controversial year, hasn't it?
Yeah.
For Tea in the Park, the Scottish music festival. I say that like it's the only music festival
it's the only
in
one.
Scotland.
It's the only one.
But I think it's probably the highest profile music festival.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. But then, so this year, it's controversy kind of started last year, really, with regard to the move from its last site, its previous site in Balado, up in Kinross, to Strathallan Castle, Perthshire. It moved because there was an oil pipe underneath the site.
Yes, and they'd had to reuse that site that they'd been using for a long time. They kept having to reconfigure because of new health and safety rules around the pipe. And then I think it had been a bit of a long time coming that eventually they would have to just stop using the site because it just became that in order to comply with health and safety, it was becoming impractical. And so they got this nice castle to host them. And then, yes, there was quite a bit of controversy. First of all, there was one running story which I read in the Scotsman. The Scottish press were covering this in quite some detail, and we covered it too. It had less press down here until it reached the amusing bit in the run-up. But there was the family that owned the castle, another part of the same family owned some land next door, and they weren't happy about it. And then some of the locals didn't want to have a big festival in what is actually a very rural part of Scotland. And then the wildlife people got involved.
Yes,
and that was when it became quite
that
amusing.
That was where it kind of came down to the wire, really, because the dispute got very close to the actual date of the festival. But there was basically there are osprey that nest in the grounds of this castle, and ospreys are a protected species. So I think it was the Woodland Trust that tried to get the festival stopped from happening on this site with just weeks to go. And this it came down to, where is this bird going to nest this year? And they just had to wait and see. And then when it did nest, It nested in the wrong place. There was a whole dispute over, like, is this too close to the site or not? And the festival will say, no, it's fine. It's far enough away. And then the other side saying, no, it's too close. But it went ahead in the end.
It did.
It was fine. Despite all of this,
but the best bit was when, in the end, the osprey did nest on the site and they managed to just construct the site around the nest so that there was an exclusion zone, so that there wouldn't be too much noise near where the birds were nesting, so that they could breed. And the festival said, you know, well, we've been negotiating this big bloody oil pipe for the last X years in our old site. We can negotiate one tree. Although there was the part a little bit earlier than that where they were trying to persuade the birds to nest somewhere else. And we kept hearing about all these things they were doing to try and persuade these birds. No, go to that tree over there. And I think they built a nest, like the super nest, the most flash nest you could ever see, and the hope that that would tempt the birds off the festival site so they wouldn't have these restrictions. But they failed. So, yes, they had to build a big circle around the birds. But as you say, for a while it looked like it might stop the festival from happening at all. Actually, I'm not sure that was ever going to happen. But
attempts were made.
It went ahead.
It did go ahead. It went ahead, and they probably got to the end and thought, phew, glad that's all over. I'm glad there's now no more controversy.
Well, except there was a bit of moaning from the locals on infrastructure. There always is with festivals.
Well,
and
that's just
places,
festivals, isn't it?
No. But there were various reports saying there must be a review before we allow the festival to take place here again on transport. But yes, but that's not the only continuing story here.
No, the controversy now is that the festival received a grant of £150,000 from the Scottish Government. And that's now being criticised by the opposition political parties against the SNP, to the extent that Scotland's Culture Secretary Fiona Hislop was called to stand up in front of the Scottish Parliament and justify this. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, fairly small amount of money for a festival. But I think the controversy is that this is a festival owned by Live Nation. What does Live Nation need £150,000 for?
Yes, so yeah, there were some people who were opposing the idea of giving money to a music festival at all. And you could say, well, that's just people being snobby and saying it's fine to give money to opera and to classical music, but you shouldn't give it to a pop music festival. And say, well, why shouldn't a pop music festival get it? And it was linked to the move, the fact that there were extra costs involved this year in order to move to this new site. So it wasn't that we're gonna state subsidise you for the foreseeable future. It was, well, there were special reasons why this year, you know, tea in the park is good for our economy. We should help with the move to ensure that the event can continue, I think was how they were justifying it.
I think also it's people not realising that actually probably quite a lot of events that they wouldn't agree with getting grants like this do get them. It's you know, I think the reason that the SNP thought this isn't a big deal is because it's just, you know, things, events apply for grants. Grants are there for events. That's it.
But as you mentioned, Tea in the Park is promoted by a company called DF Concerts, which is a Scottish-based promoter. But they are then, in turn, majority-owned by Live Nation, or one of Live Nation's many JVs, the same company that owns Festival Republic and companies like that. And so you could say, well, OK, even if we agree to providing funding to pop music and rock music events, then that's fine. As you say, actually, in the wider scheme of things, 150 grand is not that much money. But, you know, biggest live music company in the world, why are we helping them out? And there was a second element to the criticism from the Tories and the Labour and the Liberal Democrats, which was that the meeting out of which supposedly the grant was given between representatives from DF and the Culture Ministry in Scotland was through a former aide to Alex Salmond, obviously former leader of SNP, still an SNP MP in Westminster. So it was somebody who had worked with him in a previous job, who at that point had been hired by DF to work on Tea in the Park. So there was a cronyism angle. So some of the critics were saying, it's not that we have a problem with supporting pop music. It's not that we necessarily have a problem with supporting big companies who do stuff that's good for our economy. And we recognise the benefits, the tourism, the blah, blah, blah. But we think that this was a bit of a sly on the side deal. Although even before going to the Scottish Parliament, the SNP had issued a statement basically disputing all of that.
Yes, the awarding of this funding followed normal procedures and was based solely on the merits of the case following an objective assessment by Scottish Government officials. That's what Fiona Hislop said.
So there you go. I mean, I think this is a story that it's sort of It's whatever you think of the SNP, this really Labour and Conservative and the Lib Dems just trying to get a little bit of political mileage is my serious political take on that. But it is interesting, you know, is what should get state funding. And when the Arts Council England launched the Momentum Music Fund, they launched it at the Great Escape, didn't they?
They did.
A few years ago with us. And obviously that was one of the first funds in England where money was being given directly to artists who were not classical, jazz or folk.
Yeah.
So rather than giving it to education programs or to festivals or to venues, they were actually giving money directly to artists, and they're still doing that. And the idea is, it's called momentum, because the idea is it's not unsigned bands, it's artists who have a bit of momentum but need a bit of help to record a record or to go on tour or that sort of stuff.
Artists who have the potential to get to the stage of being a big artist but just need a little kick to get there.
And either they're just a little bit too early in their career for a major record company, say, or a major promoter to invest, or they're making the sorts of music where actually it would be risky for one of the sort of more commercial music companies to invest. But I remember the problem with that is, as I say, it was for artists who were not classical, not jazz and not folk. And the challenge they had is, well, what do you call that? What the genre of music that is not classical, not jazz, not folk, how do you refer to it? And so just for speed, somebody connected to the whole thing had said pop music.
Yes.
It's just support pop music. And then, of course, that meant boss of Arts Council on the Today programme being said, what are you doing giving taxpayers' money to One Direction? And it's like, that's not what we mean. But, it's an interesting thing of you know, where does state funding go? And if we're going to fund the arts, OK, if you think that that's a good thing, then really you should be funding all sorts of artistic work and cultural stuff, not just saying, oh, well, that genre and that art form, that should be getting lots of government money. Oh, but that's commercial, so we shouldn't fund that.
Yeah, is that idea of you should fund the stuff that's dying, that no one wants, and not the stuff that has the potential to actually make some money back.
Yes, the things that people actually enjoy consuming is the sort of stuff that there should be no funding for. But it was an interesting extra little scandal around Tea in the Park. I'm sure the guys there will be hoping that next year, when I'm assuming they will return to the castle, hopefully they'll overcome any transport logistical issues, and perhaps they'll have a slightly quieter year where they can just focus on, you know, booking some bloody bands.
Yeah.
And not doing all of this political stuff.
Good luck with that.
Good luck. Right.
Right.
Let's find out what Andy Malt has been approving this week in the CMU Daily. Although, once again, Bigsy's been doing a lot of approving of
this
late.
This is becoming a tradition.
I don't actually know what Bigsy's up to these days, but he's a medic by trade.
Yes.
So I fear that he should be saving people's lives and spending less time approving pop music for CMU. But we like the fact that he's approving pop music for CMU, not that this is really pop music. Harley Blue was his tip this week.
Harley Blue is more soul, I think, than pop. Maybe soul pop.
Pop soul.
Pop soul, yes. She's got a new EP out. It's the second in a series of EPs. I'm not sure if there's a longer series of EPs, but there are two Futurespective EPs that she has released. The second one, On True Thought, just come out. Features collaborations with Spectra Soul from Shogun Audio, Captain Supernova, and Audio Sparks, who is from Bugs in the Attic. And, says Vigsy, she takes things slightly more towards the club and electronic scene with considerable aplomb on this EP.
So there you go, Vigsy's tip this week. As you're incapable of saving anyone's life, we'll allow you to carry on approving at usual levels. And the first one you approved this week was Emmy Costa.
This is a band who are based in Sweden, although I think they're a trio from all over Europe. They describe their sound as post-club, which is, I think, a reasonable description of their sound. It seems to sit in that sort of point in the evening where you're not sure if it's late at night or early in the morning. This new track called Snowboy, which I think is their second single, it has this bass line that sort of sounds like it's coming through the wall of a club. It's sort of a bit like a memory of the night you've left. And then it's got these reverb heavy vocals, and like their first track, it develops this kind of very distinct atmosphere to their sound, which you can hear in a live setting earlier in the evening than after clubbing, unless you go clubbing very early. At the Hoxton Square Bar and Kitchen on the 9th of October.
So go check that out. Mm. Next is Boots.
Boots, who is...
Nothing to do with Little Boots.
Nothing
it's
to
not
do
Little
Boots,
Boots grown up. It's become Boots.
No. This is Boots, who is a producer from the US called Jordan Asher. Who
worked with a lot of people.
He's worked with a lot of people. He's worked with Run the Jewels, FKA Twigs, and I would say most significantly, he was heavily involved in the last Beyoncé album, the one she surprise released, you might remember.
I do, although it's actually quite a long time ago now.
Well, yeah, 2013, a couple of years. And so since then, he's worked with Run DJ Jules and FKA Twigs, but he's also been working on his debut solo album, which is out, I think, in November. But he's already released various tracks from it, and the latest one is called Bombs Away. Which is another... I've heard the album. It's a very good album. And Bombs Away is a good introduction to it. It's sort of his music. You can kind of see how his sound has been twisted into other people's. How he's come to work with other people and what he's contributed. He's sort of, you can identify all these different influences like rock and hip-hop, R&B, a bit of pop as well in his sound. But it kind of... they're sort of flashes of those genres that your brain then sort of loses a grasp on because it's such a
hard to categorise.
Hard to categorise. He mixes up the sounds. It's worth checking out.
And finally, Esther Joy Lane.
Esther Joy Lane, who is a singer, producer, musician from Oxford, who is about to release her debut EP, which is called Esther Joy Lane. It just makes things that much easier to not have too many different names for things.
Although, can we just clarify that is an eponymous album, not a self-titled album?
Yes, that is...
Don't like the term self-titled.
Self-titled.
Every record's self-titled.
All albums are self-titled because you title them yourself.
Exactly. And eponymous is a good word and it should be used.
The sooner we all agree on that... Yeah. We're not talking about that.
No.
Using up valuable time.
She's got all the time in the world.
we might as well just kick back.
Yeah.
No, Esther Joy Lane. Right.
Yeah.
So she's got this EP coming out, as we've established, and she, she's fairly new on the scene. Although she's been around a little while, she's been supported by BBC Introducing.
She played
at Independent Venue Week, I think, where she had
Venue
her
Week.
First proper live show last year, possibly. And she's had a few tracks kicking around as demos for a little while.
But this is the first proper release.
This is the first proper release. And the track that I've included in the approved this week is called Travelling Light. And it's a re-recording of one of those demos. And it's really, it sort of shows how she's developed in the last year or two. And it's just good. Her kind of, I guess you'd call it pop. Her sound's got this sort of classic pop feel. It feels like music that's going to stick around. And I think it's just, I put this track in because it's a re-recording of an older track and you can kind of see how she's developed. And I think that you can see the speed she's developing and you can see that like maybe in a year, 2 years' time, she's going to be someone really, really exciting. So one to watch now.
Pop music. She should move to Scotland and they'll give her £150,000.
They give money to anyone
exactly.
in Scotland.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved to read more and listen and watch. Were there videos? I don't know. But listen or watch or consume. That's enough CMU approved.
Back to digital music now and subscriptions for such things. YouTube and Amazon have both been up to stuff this week. Which do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about YouTube.
Okay, that's good because YouTube is first in the list and it's much easier. So YouTube, a little while ago, pretended that it was launching a music streaming service.
A little
service.
While ago, a year ago almost. It was last November, I think. Yeah.
Called YouTube Music Key. And it pretended that it was going to launch a music streaming paid subscription service so that labels and artists would just get off their back.
This is Andy Malt furthering a conspiracy theory here, which I think he shares with Mark Mulligan, a music business analyst. I'm pretty sure I was on a panel with him earlier this year where he was basically saying the same thing. So yeah, YouTube obviously already is one of the biggest streaming music services in the world, if not the biggest streaming music service in the world. A lot of people, when they want to listen to music, they go to YouTube, they create playlists. I still suspect that a lot of people, when they use YouTube for music, sometimes they're going to discover new music or they've got a song in their head and they want to see it there and then. But I think the people who playlist on YouTube are probably playlisting and they're minimizing the browser and using it as if it was a streaming service, as if it was an audio streaming service. And of course, it's all free because it's an advertising-funded platform. And we know that the labels used to be okay with YouTube, but I think because services like Spotify and Deezer keep saying YouTube's a big competitor for us, and while they're free, we have to continue having a free service. The labels have been quite down on YouTube of late, and your conspiracy theory is that given it's taken them so bloody long to, A, get Music Key even into beta, and then it's been in beta for nearly a year, is actually, was this just a ruse to shut the labels up by saying, oh, don't worry about the fact that, you know, we're a free service that doesn't pay as big a royalties as everybody else, and where is YouTube heading? It's fine. We're going to launch a subscription service, and we're going to turn all of those freebie users, all those millions of people who get their music for free on YouTube, we'll turn them into subscribers by having our own Spotify type service that's fully integrated into the YouTube platform. And and every time the YouTube executives or Google executives speak at sort of music or content conferences, they keep saying, yeah, it's coming. We're getting a lot of feedback. They keep saying that. We're taking all the feedback from
feedback.
From the 87 people who are using it in beta. We're taking their feedback and we're developing the service. And the last we heard was I think it was going to be September was going to be the launch. And
it was supposed to be launched in September. Although they said even a few months ago, they told, I think it was Music Ally, said, so what's happening with this? And they went, yeah, probably not going to be September.
So we're looking sort of October, November. So we still don't actually know when YouTube Music Key is going live. For a moment, we thought it was going live because the people who were on the beta received an email a few weeks ago saying, oh, beta's ending, you're going to stop paying for this service. And then another email went out saying, oh, no, sorry, that was a mistake. That email should never have gone out. So we still don't actually know when Music Key is going live. However, aside from what's happening with Music Key, something else is happening with YouTube and subscriptions.
Well, there's been, I mean, the rumour that YouTube is planning to launch a wider subscription service for just video content on the site, not just the music, that's been doing the rounds for a long time.
No, and I think YouTube have been dabbling with subscription for years, although originally you sort of got the impression that their idea was you'd still have the main YouTube, which would be free, but then there would be strands. So you'd have Music Key would be a strand, but there would be other strands of content that you would pay for. So YouTube at large would be a free service, but then they would upsell individual channels. But the latest indications are that they're going to basically have a YouTube-wide subscription. You pay one chunk of money, and then basically it turns off the ads across the whole platform.
Yes, and so Recode reported this week that YouTube had emailed content owners it echoes the emails sent to independent labels that caused such a fuss. Was that last year? Oh, seems like just yesterday.
Yeah, so content creators on
great
YouTube.
Great times. Anyway, so it echoes that email that went out. Basically, this says, you need to sign up to these new terms or we're going to take down all your content.
And as far as I can see, this has been much less controversial than that email you mentioned that went out to the indie labels, where the indie labels all went, aah! And it was sort of their, 2014 hissy fit, wasn't it? It was YouTube, whereas this year it was Apple Music. Whereas I don't think most content owners on YouTube have particular problems with these new terms, but crucially what they are enabling is YouTube to start having ad-free, paid-for content rather than it all being on ad funded, so that if you have a YouTube channel, some people will come in to your channel and watch adverts and share the revenue with you, as has always been the case. But premium users who come in to consume your content, well, YouTube will share you the subscription revenue, so you'll still be earning as a content owner, but some will be coming from ad share and some will be coming from paid for users, assuming YouTube can persuade anyone to become a paid for user. So as you say, I mean, I think people have been seeing that coming for a while, and that email that Recode reported on and then various other people then started posting the email online. Crucially, it has a deadline in it, doesn't it?
Yes, you need to agree to these terms by the 22nd of October, which would suggest that this supposed subscription service is launching sooner rather than later.
And I think it's specifically American terms or something. So it might be that something's happening in America that won't initially happen elsewhere.
The specific quote was, if you don't sign up for these terms, your videos will no longer be available for public display or monetization in the United States.
So content owners, get your terms updated so that US people can continue to watch your content. What is coming? But then the other bit of rumour that Recode had in the same story when they published that email was, OK, what we now have incoming is Music Key eventually is meant to be going live and people can start paying for it. The YouTube subscription service is finally coming. People will be able to start paying for it. But actually, say the gossipers, They're going to be the same service.
Yes, and that is interesting because that was not going to be the original plan.
And it poses the question, is how will this be presented? How will it be branded? Because we expected Music Key to be a big standalone brand and have a big push and be a service in its own right. But it may well be that the big push is YouTube Premium or whatever they decide to call it. I think there was a name doing the rounds that they think people are going to use.
Well, look at Music Key. It would be a terrible name. It's Google. All Google names are terrible.
It will be YouTube pay for content and not get ads. Zoom or something like that. I don't know. And that Music Key may well be just part of the service, which is interesting for music companies because presumably if people are paying, because this is indeed what people are saying, it will still be $10, £10, €10 a month to have ad-free YouTube, which will include Music Key. And the original assumption was with Music Key that the entire £10 would be just going on the music service, which would make it quite like Spotify and Deezer. About 70% of that would be shared with music rights owners. And I imagine the framework of that deal will still be in place, but not all the money is going to go to music rights owners because all the other YouTube content owners will be able to share in that money too. So you could say at first, look, that's not good for the music companies because it means they're going to have to share the money further. Although I would assume that YouTube would say, but this has way more potential. You know, we reckon we'll get many, many more people signing up to this. And so even though the money's also going to be shared out with all of the other YouTube channels, overall, this is going to be a good thing. Which brings us, and you mentioned Amazon.
Yes.
Which brings us to the point that, well, actually, what would be interesting with that is that rather than YouTube having a standalone music service that goes head-to-head with Spotify and Deezer and Apple Music, etc., this could be YouTube saying, well, let's not go and compete with them head on. Let's be a service that brings music in with other video and other content and other entertainment and sell that as a service, which comes to the idea that lots of people have been saying ultimately there is a market for standalone streaming services and that market is being exploited by the Spotify's and Apple Music's of this world. But there's a much bigger market to offer lots of services of which music is one component.
Yes, because as we've said before, for most people don't really like music that much. For most people, music is a thing that happens, and that's nice.
Yeah, certainly not enough for £120
a
year.
They don't want to spend £120 a year on it because, as far as they're concerned, it's just a thing that happens. A
couple of albums
in
that
the corner,
excited
on the
about,
radio.
And exactly, most of it is just happening ambient on the radio.
Which brings us to Amazon Prime Music, which is part of the Amazon Prime service, which is basically a subscription service that gets you next day delivery for free. Well, not for free, obviously, because you pay for it. But you pay your annual fee and then, yeah, anything you order on Amazon that's covered by Prime, you get free next day delivery at that point. And that's great. And then as a Prime member, you get these extra things. So you get access to their movie streaming service and you also get access to their music service.
There's also
other bits as well.
There's ebooks because basically they launched it as a next day delivery. Then over the years they've been adding all the extra bits on.
Yes.
And talking of terrible names, because the ebooks bit is called something like the Amazon Prime ebook lending library online something. So they can have some terrible names too. But they added music in the US last year. They added it in the UK earlier this year.
Yes.
The development this week though,
they have Universal on board. They haven't, although this service has been going for, you know, for a year now. In the US and, you know, a few months in the UK, it's never had Universal content on board, which is normally the killer for a streaming service. All streaming services want to get Universal on board first, usually, because Universal owns
the biggest.
Almost all the music in the world.
And a big chunk of it.
It's the biggest record label in the world. They own a lot of music. And so it's very important to have their music on your service, otherwise you're missing a lot of it. But the It sort of was okay with Amazon Prime Music because the selling point of it, not that it is a selling point really because it's a bolt onto something else, but you know, its USP is that it's a limited service. It doesn't offer new releases particularly and it only offers a limited catalogue. It's mainly kind of playlist focused. But they kind of built it. But this may be I think we've discussed before, originally this may be a problem of licensing this service, but they've really kind of made it a big thing.
Yeah, curated.
It's curated, and you only get access to, I think when it launched in the States, it was like, they were like, you only get access to 1 million tracks, but we've created the best tracks, the ones that you want, we've put them in playlists for you, and it's all old stuff.
That's what you want.
That's what you want, really.
That's what you want. And I'd say that has sort of become a sell to the punter too, but originally it was also a sell to the record industry, because this is a bolt-on. the money has to be shared in lots of different places, with movies, with books, with the free service. As it is, Amazon Prime in this country is nowhere near what a Spotify subscription is.
No, £79
yeah.
a year.
So for 80 quid, you're getting everything. So clearly, of the 80 quid, only a little tiny bit of that's available for
music.
I think
it's interesting that if you were a Love Film user, you're paying for your Love Film account. When you when Amazon bought that and transferred it over to their own, the Love Film DVD service that still exists as a standalone thing.
Yeah, but the streaming bit became part of Amazon
became
Prime.
Part of Amazon Prime. And so if you were a Love Film customer, when they transferred that over, they just gave you the video bit. You didn't get the free delivery bit by default. But that costs £71 a year. So for another £8... you get the free delivery as well.
Is this,
so you kind of wonder where...
Is this Amazon Prime ad that suddenly has appeared in the middle of this podcast?
If they want to pay us some money, that is fine.
Then Andy will talk up what good value it is.
But I think what my point was, what's interesting is like that the if the video service costs £71
yes,
a year...
how much could there be for
£8 a year extra gets you music, ebooks, and free delivery.
So the
point
is...
there's not a lot of money kicking around.
There is less money to go round, and so the sell to the music industry was twofold, which is A, well, we don't want anywhere near as much content from you as a Spotify-type service, and crucially, because of that limited play, we're not competing with Spotify, we're not competing with Deezer, we're making you a bit of money from the sorts of consumers who would never sign up to pay for a streaming service. And that, so basically, it's free money. Because it's money off consumers who you will never turn into paying subscribers of a full-on standalone streaming service.
Yes.
And sort of the gossip is that Universal were not impressed with that argument initially, because Sony and Warner were both there from day one. But a year on, they've sort of reluctantly accepted, well, OK, it is free money, we should sign up. And crucially, whereas a Spotify, as you said right at the start, whereas a Spotify-type service just could not operate without Universal's catalogue, because of the way Amazon Prime have set it up, they clearly can, because they've been doing well for a year without it. So as the months went by, Universal's negotiating hand just got weaker, because Amazon could keep saying, well, everything's going fine here without you. So, yeah, Universal now on board. So there may well be some Justin Bieber in Amazon Prime now.
Yeah,
and we'll come back to Bieber shortly.
We will do. Although I think it's worth noting at this point...
Note it.
...that what's interesting about both of these things is that, you know, for years now, the kind of all the big streaming services, your Spotify's, your Deezer's, your Rhapsody's, Napster, it's the same thing, Audio. I'm just listing them now. Anyway, what they've all been kind of focusing on, like, oh, how do we get mainstream subscribers onto our streaming services? How do we convince them to sign up and pay their monthly fee? And they've all been agonising over this for years, and there's been lots and lots of debate over it. And it's sort of, you wonder if actually... like YouTube and Amazon might just have worked it out. It's like you get mainstream subscribers by giving them a music streaming service without them realising, because they don't want a music streaming service. But if it's there, they might use it.
It may be seen how YouTube spin, assuming this is what happens with YouTube Music Key. It'll be interesting to see how they spin it. But Amazon, for certain, say exactly that. If you want to reach this part of the audience, bolt the music on, okay? There's no point trying to sell it to them, they won't buy it. But if you bolt it on, they'll use it, and then you'll get some revenue you wouldn't otherwise have. So this has really turned into an Amazon Prime love fest. I'm not even an Amazon Prime customer, but I would expect my free subscription in the post in due course.
Before we get to the aforementioned Justin Bieber, let's have a quick look at the few of the stories we didn't have time to discuss this week. Zane Lowe is not sure if Apple Music even needs Beats 1.
Neither am I. So, although me and him both.
To be fair, he was a lot more positive than that statement sounds. But we haven't got time to discuss
it. We haven't.
The British Eurovision Song Choice is going back to a public vote, which is a terrible idea because the public are all idiots. SFX Entertainment, which we've discussed quite a lot lately, is now apparently considering a fire sale after its share price dipped yet again after a pretty disastrous edition of the Tomorrow World Festival.
Which is sort of a tabloid, a sensationalist way of saying that the asset sale they were already doing looks like they might be speeding that up now because they need the cash. But anyway, keep an eye on SFX. We may well be talking about them again next week.
Contacta, which I believe is the way we decided it was
you
said.
You decided.
Yeah. Has been ordered by a court in Russia to implement a more rigid takedown system.
It being the Russian Facebook.
Yes. After being sued by Warner Music and Universal Music. and in fact Sony Music, but they pulled out.
They did.
Anyway, we don't have time to talk about that. Aldi has launched a streaming service in Germany. It is powered by Napster, and it undercuts all the other streaming services.
Yeah, living up to its name. So
yeah.
I'm a bit of, I think they're calling it Aldi Music or something like that, but to be true to their form, they should have called it Noopster, and it's basically Napster, but it's cheaper. That would have been much better. So I should be working in Aldi's marketing department. That's the conclusion of this.
Back to Russia. Vladimir Putin has now called Elton John. It's all right, and it was like for real this time.
So everything is now fine. Gay rights in Russia are all sorted.
They are going to have a meeting, although I think the real Putin was a bit more vague about when than the fake Putin.
We're alluding to the wind-up phone call in which Elton John was told to come right away and have a conversation.
But alluding is all we'll do, because we don't have time to talk about that, because we have to talk for quite some time now about Justin Bieber's new interview in Complex magazine.
Despite the fact that last week, having been a super fast, speedy edition of the podcast, this is looking like it may be the longest one ever. But, you know, no pressure. Let's sit back and enjoy the all-new messiah-like Bieber giving an interview, a proper serious magazine interview, not a silly pop music interview, a serious interview about his life, past, present and future.
Bieber is often giving serious interviews these days. I think it was Men's Health he was interviewed by, which he said some amusing things. Bieber, this is my favourite era of Bieber, I think. I'm very much enjoying this. After years of reporting on him and just, you know, being a bad boy, being very, very naughty, he's now seen the error of his ways.
And he's being humorously worthy.
He's being incredibly worthy, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Two parts to this interview. There's the Jesus bit, which we'll come on to. Yeah. But first of all, he did go to those bad boy events that we've just mentioned. He discussed some of them.
Well, he did. What's sort of interesting is in other kind of post-revelatory interviews, he sort of said that he's ashamed of his behaviour in recent years and how he really wants to turn things around now. In this one, he sort of denied that he'd ever done anything.
He started off by saying it wasn't my fault, it was the people around me.
He did take some responsibility for it, but he said, you know, that I was surrounded by some people who weren't helping.
Which you almost certainly were.
And I've had to cut some people off. And he was saying, actually, I was surrounded by like some people who were very nice and helpful and some people who weren't. And then you notice more the people who aren't really helping you, and you just become fixated on that, and then you think the world's against you, and then you start doing all the stuff that he did, throwing eggs, pissing in buckets, things like that.
But as you say, some of the things are both the silly things, but also the criminal things that occurred during this period.
Yeah.
He was reinventing them.
The criminal things are a criminal thing for which he was convicted. Although, you know, he would say he reached a plea deal.
And he wasn't convicted of the most serious of the charges that we
know. No, but, I mean, he did.
This was the drag racing allegation.
He was accused of drag racing in the streets of Miami while under the influence of drugs and alcohol.
But those were the charges that were dropped as part of the plea bargain. It was more resisting arrest and being rude to a police officer and things like that he took. He took the charges for.
So in this interview, he basically said, I was never drag racing. This was just this policeman that wanted to get famous for arresting celebrities, which hasn't worked because I've got no idea who that policeman was, although I still remember who Justin Bieber was. So I don't know what that says.
It says nothing.
But let's pretend I made a point.
Good point. Good point, Andy Malt. I'm going to write that down.
He also brought up the previously mentioned pissing in a bucket incident, which
was only news because one of his friends filmed it.
Yeah. And then, well, in both these occasions, there is video of these things happening, right? Where you can watch the video and go, yeah, he does seem like he's resisting arrest. He also seems like he might be under the influence of drugs and alcohol. But he says, no, he was not. He may have had a couple of beers earlier in the day, but no. And then he just got angry because he felt like he hadn't done anything, because he hadn't.
As for the pissing in the bucket, I pissed in the bucket.
Yeah, he was like,
what of it?
He was like, I was backstage in a club. I needed to go to the toilet, but the toilet was on the other side of the club, that's a hassle, isn't it? And then someone said, why don't you piss in that bucket? Someone, like a bouncer, said, why don't you piss in that bucket? So he did. And then, you know, there was all this fuss. There was no fuss. He said, like, you know, if Ozzy Osbourne had done that, you'd say, wow, what a rock star. I don't know that I would.
Any aspiring rock stars, that's not how you become
also,
a rock star.
Also, stories about Ozzy Osbourne are like, well, pissing on the Alamo is that. That's like, you know, That's a bit. That's a level above pissing in a bucket.
Up your game if you want to be considered rock and roll.
If you want to be Ozzy Osbourne, you're going to have to up your game. But he doesn't want to be Ozzy Osbourne, because as we said, he's turned a new leaf, and he now wants to be Jesus.
He's always been a bit Jesus-ish.
He has.
So this is sort of returning to form.
Yes, but quite a large chunk of this interview was quite God-based. I say he wants to be. He said he wants to live like Jesus. He did note not be Jesus,
which is just as well, because that job's been taken a long time ago.
Yeah,
done,
yeah.
Dusted.
Although he did then talk sort of like he thought he might be Jesus. He compared their lives. Do you like to know how he compared the lives?
Yeah, how is Justin Bieber's life like Jesus of what's Jesus' surname? Christ, is that his surname? Jesus of Nazareth's life. Well, don't remember Jesus pissing in a bucket. Now I must admit, I've not read the entire New Testament. Perhaps it's recalled in one of Paul's letters that I haven't read, but I don't remember Jesus pissing
in
a bucket.
Maybe in that cave. You know, it was probably in that cave for a little while. Might have been a bucket.
There might have been a bucket in the cave.
Anyway, Justin Bieber says...
I know the Bible's open to interpretation, but I'm pretty sure that requires quite an interpretation. Anyway, Justin Bieber says...
That's what it says. Anyway, here's what Justin said. Sometimes, when I don't feel like doing something, but I know it's right, I remember I'm pretty sure Jesus didn't feel like going on the cross and dying so that we don't have to feel what we should have to feel. Which I think sums it up nicely.
It is. It's true.
Justin Bieber's like, don't want to piss in a bucket, but someone said I should piss in a bucket. And Jesus pissed in a bucket, as we've just established.
As we've just discussed.
And also, you know, was crucified.
And
that.
Was crucified.
So that's that sorted.
Good. That's all very clear.
He's also said that if God's for me, who can be against me? That's helped me in a lot of situations where I feel judged. So he's explained his relationship to God and how God's helped him get through this difficult time of not drag racing and misrepresentations of him urinating in buckets. He also explains some things.
He does. So he moves on from sort of how Jesus influences his life to then sort of talking about some classic, particularly in America, issues that Christians might have with those bloody scientists and their bloody... Yeah. Explanations for this bloody universe.
Yeah, I mean...
Water on Mars, what do they know?
He noted that, you know, he'd been for a little while convinced by the Big Bang Theory.
The theory, not the TV show.
Not the TV show. No one's convinced by the TV show. It's awful. Actually, a lot of people are convinced by it. But you're all idiots. It's really awful. What's the matter with you? Anyway, we're not talking about that.
We're not talking about that.
We're talking about the actual theory of the Big Bang. And I think Justin's won me round because he said... Imagine putting a bunch of gold into a box, shaking up the box, and out comes a Rolex. It's so preposterous once people start saying it. And the thing is, he's tried to use that as an example of how the Big Bang Theory is wrong. But the point of the Big Bang Theory is that in a universe that is infinite, everything is possible.
It is.
So what he's just said is actually possible.
So, yeah. I mean, presumably he pulled that off intelligentdesignwebsite.com. It's better than the banana explanation. But, so that's fun. And as you say, this isn't the only interview like this Bieber has given.
No,
so, can we? Oh, you got another thing you want to share?
One more quote.
Go on. The
best quote in the interview.
Okay. And let's wrap up the whole podcast with this. This is the finale, everybody.
A good one to finish
on. This 4.5-day podcast is now going to end with this final classic Justin Bieber quote. Quotes by Justin Bieber.
You don't need to go to church to be a Christian. If you go to Taco Bell, that doesn't make you a taco.
There's no way you can argue with that. He's got
something
it nailed.
To think about.
It is. A little thought for the day. Perhaps that could be a new feature on the podcast. Another jingle is required here, Matt. It could be Bieber's thought of the day. And we could collect all the quotes. And every week you could share one with our listeners. So, that's coming up next week on the CMU podcast.
I would like Justin Bieber to stop making music and just say things like that. Just once a day, like you say, Bieber's thought of the day. Once a day, we just have that. It would be much more enjoyable than his music, although his music career does seem to be kicking off again
it
now.
It does, doesn't it? So he'll probably will be focusing more on that.
Maybe he could sing things like that.
Those could be his lyrics.
Yeah.
So there you go. Anyway, do that wrap-up thing that you do at the end of the podcast, and then I can go home.
Okay, well, why don't you tweet us at CMU with your thoughts on whether or not Justin Bieber is the Messiah? That's your task for this week. Or you could tell us that in a review on iTunes, which I think would be thoroughly confusing for everyone.
And so therefore you should do it.
You should definitely do that.
You could compare listening to Senior Podcast to the life of Jesus.
Yes, yes, definitely.
It is a bit like being crucified, I think. that could be the quote. If you someone could put that on iTunes and then we could use it, that would be great.
5 stars, a bit like being crucified.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Do that. I want like 10 people to do that by next week. Anyway, this podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more information on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
I might have a little sneeze while we're in a break.
Harley Blue, is that how you say this?
Huh? Yeah, probably.